A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the suicidal ideation side effect that shows up with certain medications, and it got him asking a bigger question. Is it even theoretically possible to develop a drug with zero side effects? Or is it just a statistical, given that once enough people take something, some of them are going to have a bad reaction? And if that's the case, what does the FDA actually consider acceptable when they're weighing safety?
That Freeman is exactly right. The question isn't safe or unsafe. It's safe enough for what and for whom. And here's the paradox that sits at the center of all of this. A drug that is powerful enough to change your biology in a way that helps you is, by definition, powerful enough to change your biology in a way that harms you. Those two things are the same property. You can't have one without the possibility of the other.
That's the thing that gets lost in a lot of the public conversation. People talk about side effects like they're a design flaw. But the mechanism that makes the drug work, and the mechanism that makes the side effect happen, those are often the same mechanism, just hitting different tissues or different people.
Take a beta blocker. It blocks beta adrenergic receptors. That's how it lowers blood pressure, blocking those receptors in the heart and blood vessels. But beta receptors also exist in the lungs, so now you've got bronchoconstriction in some patients. That's not a mistake. That's the drug doing exactly what it was designed to do, just in a place you didn't want it to.
It's like hiring a plumber who fixes your leak but also floods your basement because he used the same wrench on the wrong pipe.
Actually, a surprisingly good analogy.
Here's what I want to sit with for a second. Daniel's question gets at something deeper than just, why do side effects exist? He's asking whether zero side effects is even a coherent concept. Like, is it theoretically possible, or is it the pharmacological equivalent of a perpetual motion machine?
It's the perpetual motion machine. There are two reasons, and they're both non-negotiable. One is biological, one is statistical. The biological reason is that human beings are not identical. We have different genetics, different metabolisms, different microbiomes, different comorbidities. A drug molecule doesn't know it's entering corn versus Herman. It just does what it does, and what happens next depends on the landscape it lands in.
The same dose produces different concentrations in different people's blood, its different receptor densities, gets cleared at different rates.
And the statistical reason is even more brutal. If a side effect occurs in 1 out of every 50,000 people, that's considered extremely rare. But if 50 million people take that drug, you've just created 1,000 cases. Clinical trials, even the big phase 3 ones, typically enroll between 1,000 and 3,000 patients. You can't see a 1 in 50,000 event in a trial of 3,000 people. It's mathematically invisible.
The drug could be perfectly safe in the trial, get approved, hit the market, and only then do we discover that it causes something catastrophic in a tiny fraction of users. And that's not a failure of the trial design. That's just the limits of what you can measure.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Daniel mentioned suicidal ideation as a side effect. That's one of those things that emerged post-market for several drugs because the trials simply weren't large enough to catch it. When you're looking at an event that might occur in 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 50,000 patients, you need post-marketing surveillance. You need hundreds of thousands or millions of people taking the drug before the signal becomes detectable.
That's with a side effect as severe as suicidal thoughts. Imagine how many milder side effects we never even catch because they don't rise to the level of a FEERS report.
FAERS, the FDA Adverse Event Reporting System. Over 20 million reports in that database. But spontaneous reporting systems like FEERS capture somewhere between 1 and 10% of actual adverse events. The other 90 to 99% never get reported. Doctors don't file the paperwork, patients don't connect the symptom to the drug, or they just don't bother.
We're flying partially blind even after a drug has been on the market for years.
We're flying with one eye open and a lot of fog. which is why the whole framework has to shift from find all the side effects to manage the ones we know about and build systems to catch the ones we don't.
Before we get to the FDA's framework, I want to stay on this impossibility question for another minute. Someone might say, okay, but what about drugs that are extremely targeted? Monoclonal antibodies that go after one specific receptor. Surely those have fewer side effects.
Even the most exquisitely targeted drug still has to be metabolized by somebody's liver, still has to be cleared by somebody's kidneys, still might trigger an immune response in somebody whose immune system decides that this antibody looks foreign. You can't design around every possible individual variation, because there are billions of possible variations.
It's almost like the concept of a side effect is baked into the concept of a drug at the definitional level. If it does something, it does something. The only question is whether that something is always good, and the answer can't be yes across 8 billion different biologies.
This is where the AI design drugs and personalized medicine angle gets interesting. If we can design drugs computationally, if we can tailor therapies to individual genetics, does that change the equation?
Right, because the promise is that we'll have fewer adverse reactions because we'll know ahead of time who's going to respond badly.
That's real, to a point. Pharmacogenomic testing can already tell you if you're a poor metabolizer for certain CYP4TF enzymes. CYP2D6 alone has four distinct metabolizer phenotypes: poor, intermediate, normal, and ultra-rapid. That one enzyme affects about a quarter of all commonly prescribed drugs. If you're an ultra-rapid metabolizer, a standard dose of codeine might hit you like a much higher dose because you're converting it to morphine faster than expected. If you're a poor metabolizer, the same dose might do almost nothing.
Knowing your CYP2D6 status could prevent some adverse events, but that's not the same as preventing all of them.
Not even close. CYP2D6 is one enzyme. There are dozens. And that's just metabolism. That doesn't account for receptor polymorphisms, transporter variations, differences in gut absorption, differences in blood-brain barrier permeability. And it absolutely doesn't account for idiosyncratic reactions.
Idiosyncratic reactions. This is the category that really drives home why zero side effects is impossible. These aren't dose-dependent, aren't predictable from the drug's mechanism, and often can't be reproduced in animal models.
Halothane hepatitis is the classic example. Halothane was a widely used inhaled anesthetic. In roughly 1 in 10,000 patients, it caused massive liver failure, not because of the dose, not because of how it was administered. It was an idiosyncratic immune-mediated reaction. The drug had been used for decades before the mechanism was understood, and there was no way to predict who it would happen to.
Even if you've done everything right. Perfect trial design, huge sample size, careful monitoring. You can still get blindsided by something that only shows up once a drug hits a large enough population.
That brings us to troglitazone, approved in 1997 for type 2 diabetes, pulled from the market in 2000. About 90 cases of liver failure out of roughly 1.9 million patients. That's a rate of about 1 in 21,000. The clinical trials couldn't have caught it. The trials would have needed to be an order of magnitude larger.
1 in 21,000. And that was enough to pull the drug.
Because liver failure is catastrophic. The FDA's calculus isn't just about frequency. It's about severity, reversibility, and what the drug is actually treating. A 1 in 21,000 risk of liver failure for a diabetes drug when there are other diabetes drugs available? That's a different equation than a 5% risk of a fatal adverse event for a terminal cancer with no other options.
The threshold moves depending on what's at stake.
And that's the core of the FDA's benefit-risk framework. There is no single number. There is no universal cutoff. It's a holistic assessment that weighs the severity of the condition, the available alternatives, the size of the treatment effect, and the nature of the adverse events.
Which means the public perception of FDA approved equals safe is missing a whole lot of nuance.
It's missing almost all of the nuance. FDA approval means the agency has determined that the benefits outweigh the known risks for the intended population. It does not mean the drug is risk-free. It does not mean all risks have been identified. It means, essentially, we've looked at what we can see, and based on what we know right now, the math works out in favor of approving this.
What we know right now is the key phrase, because post-market surveillance keeps rewriting that equation.
Vioxx is the canonical example, approved in 1999. Pulled in 2004. About 80 million people had taken it by the time the cardiovascular risk became undeniable. The absolute risk increase over placebo was about 1.5%. That doesn't sound like much until you multiply it by 80 million.
That's over a million people.
The clinical trials did show a cardiovascular signal. It was there in the data. But it was debated, it was contested, and it took years of post-market use before the evidence became overwhelming. The system worked in the sense that the drug was eventually withdrawn, but it also demonstrated just how long it can take for a rare but serious signal to become clear.
If we accept that side effects are inevitable, and we accept that clinical trials will always miss some of them, the question Daniel's really asking is about the regulatory philosophy. What is the FDA actually trying to achieve when it evaluates safety?
They're trying to establish that the side effects common enough to detect in trials are tolerable, and that the systems are in place to catch the rare ones after approval. It's a two-stage safety net. The pre-market stage establishes a baseline. The post-market stage does the real surveillance work.
The pre-market baseline. What does that actually look like in terms of numbers?
The FDA generally expects that common adverse events, meaning those occurring in 5% or more of patients, are characterized and manageable. For serious adverse events, the expectation is typically that rates are below 1 to 2% above placebo. But these are guidelines, not bright line rules. The agency has enormous discretion to weigh the specifics of each case.
A drug for hay fever with a 2% rate of serious adverse events would be dead on arrival. But a drug for glioblastoma with the same profile might get fast-tracked.
And that's not inconsistent, that's rational. The risk you're willing to accept is proportional to the risk you're already facing from the disease. Untreated glioblastoma kills you in months. A 2% risk of a serious adverse event looks very different in that context than it does when you're treating seasonal allergies.
Which brings us to one of the more interesting examples in regulatory history.
Isotretinoin is a known teratogen. If taken during pregnancy, the risk of severe fetal malformations is somewhere between 20 and 35%. That's not a rare side effect. That's a near certainty if exposure happens at the wrong time. And yet the drug has never been withdrawn.
Because severe cystic acne is disfiguring and psychologically devastating, and isotretinoin is remarkably effective.
Because the FDA didn't just say, this risk is acceptable. They said this risk is manageable through a structured program. That's what REMS is, Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy. Mandatory pregnancy testing, mandatory contraception, monthly monitoring, a restricted distribution system. The drug stays on the market, but the system around it is designed to prevent the worst outcome.
The FDA's answer to, can we eliminate this risk, was no, but we can build a fence around it.
That's the mature regulatory philosophy, not zero risk. The question isn't, does this drug have side effects? The question is, can we live with the side effects it has, given what it does, and can we put systems in place to minimize the harm?
That's where I think the public conversation goes sideways. People hear FDA approved, and they think someone has verified that this is safe for me to take. What they should hear is, a panel of experts has determined that, for the average patient with this condition, the expected benefit exceeds the expected harm, and systems exist to monitor for unexpected harm going forward.
That's a much harder message to fit on a label.
It's also a much harder message to internalize when you're the one staring at a prescription bottle wondering if you're going to be the one in 50,000.
That's the psychological reality that regulatory frameworks can't solve. Statistics are comforting at the population level. They're meaningless at the individual level. If you're the one who gets the idiosyncratic liver failure, the fact that it only happened to 1 in 21,000 people is not comforting.
If I'm a patient, what am I supposed to do with all of this? Just accept that there's a lottery and hope my number doesn't come up?
But partly, you can ask better questions. When a doctor prescribes something, most patients ask about common side effects. Will this make me drowsy? Will it upset my stomach? Very few ask the questions that actually matter for rare but serious risk. What was the rate of serious adverse events in the clinical trials? What post-market surveillance is in place for this drug? Has the FDA required a REMS program, and if not, why not?
Those are good questions. I suspect most doctors would be surprised to hear them.
They would, and they'd probably have to look up the answers, which is fine. The point is to shift the conversation from, is this drug safe, to what do we know and what don't we know about this drug's safety profile? That's a much more honest framing.
It loops back to Daniel's original observation. The suicidal ideation side effect got a lot of media attention, precisely because it's the kind of thing that feels like it should have been caught. How do you not notice that your drug makes some people want to kill themselves? But if the rate is 1 in 10,000, and your trial had 3,000 patients, you might see zero cases. It's not negligence. It's math.
When you do see one or two cases in a trial of 3,000, the statistical question becomes brutal. Is that signal or noise? One case of suicidal ideation in a depressed population, is that the drug or is that the depression? Untangling that requires sample sizes that are simply not feasible in pre-market testing.
The system is built on a kind of humility. We test what we can test. We approve when the known benefits outweigh the known risks, and then we watch. The watching never stops.
The watching never stops. And that's actually the part of the system that works best, even though it's the part nobody sees. Fears, the Sentinel Initiative, the post-marketing requirements, the FDA imposes as a condition of approval. That's where the real safety signal detection happens. Not in the pristine conditions of a clinical trial, but in the messy reality of millions of people taking the drug alongside their other medications in their actual lives.
There's something almost philosophical here. The quest for a side effect-free drug is the quest for a drug that only interacts with the part of your biology you want it to interact with. But biology doesn't work in compartments. Everything is connected to everything else. You can't tweak one pathway without tugging on five others.
The more we learn about biology, the more connected it turns out to be. The gut-brain axis. The immune-neuroendocrine connections. The more we know, the more implausible the idea of a perfectly clean drug becomes.
Daniel's question, is it even possible to develop a medication with no side effects? The answer is no. Not just not with current technology, but not in principle. It's a category error. It's asking for a drug that isn't a drug.
Which is not to say we can't get better at this. Pharmacogenomics, better trial designs, AI-assisted signal detection and post-market data, more sophisticated understanding of individual risk factors. All of that is improving. But the goal isn't zero side effects. The goal is fewer surprises, faster detection, and better tools for predicting who's at risk. Let's put some numbers on this, because the math is where it really gets sobering. Take a drug that causes a serious adverse event in 1 out of every 10,000 people. That's rare by any clinical definition. Now give that drug to the adult population of the United States, roughly 330 million people. You're looking at about 33,000 cases.
33,000 people harmed by something that happens 1/100th of a percent of the time. That's the tyranny of large numbers.
That's with a 1 in 10,000 rate. Troglitazone had a liver failure rate of roughly 1 in 21,000, about 90 cases among 1.9 million patients. That was enough to pull it from the market. But the clinical trials that got Rezolin approved enrolled about 2,500 patients. You can't see a 1 in 21,000 event in a trial of 2,500 people. It's not that the trial was badly designed. It's that the event was mathematically undetectable at that scale.
What would it actually take to catch something that rare before approval?
The rule of thumb is that to reliably detect an adverse event, you need roughly 3 times the reciprocal of its frequency. So to catch a 1 in 10,000 event, you need about 30,000 patients. To catch a 1 in 100,000 event, you need 300,000. Phase 3 trials for most drugs run between 1,000 and 3,000 patients. The gap between what we test and what we need to test is an order of magnitude, sometimes 2.
Nobody's going to run a 300,000-person trial for a new blood pressure medication. The cost would be in the billions, and by the time you finished, the patent would be half expired.
The economics make it impossible, but even if you fix the economics, the biology would still be a problem. Because humans metabolize drugs differently at the genetic level, and no trial size can fully account for that.
This is the CYP4TIFI stuff you mentioned, CYP2D6 and its 4 metabolizer types.
CYP2D6 is one enzyme in the cytochrome P450 family responsible for metabolizing about a quarter of all commonly prescribed drugs. Antidepressants, antipsychotics, beta blockers, opioids. Depending on which variant of the gene you inherited, you're a poor metabolizer, intermediate, normal, or ultra-rapid. Four different people take the same dose of the same drug, and four completely different things happen inside their bodies. A poor metabolizer taking codeine gets almost no pain relief. An ultra-rapid metabolizer taking the same dose essentially gets a morphine overdose. Same pill, same dose, wildly different outcomes. And that's just one enzyme. CYP2C19 affects clopidogrel. CYP2C9 affects warfarin. TPMT affects thiopurines.
This is all before we even get to the truly weird stuff. The idiosyncratic reactions.
Idiosyncratic drug reactions are adverse events, not predictable from the drug's known mechanism, not dose-dependent, and not reproducible in animal models. They're rare, they're severe, and they often involve the immune system deciding that a drug molecule looks like an invader. Halothane hepatitis. The body's immune system was generating antibodies against liver proteins modified by a halothane metabolite. Clozapine, one of the most effective antipsychotics we have, causes a granulocytosis in about 1% of patients. We monitor for it with regular blood draws under a REMS, but we still don't fully understand why some people get it and others don't.
The idiosyncratic reactions are essentially the immune system's version of friendly fire. It's not that the drug is toxic in the traditional sense. It's that someone's immune system has decided the drug is an enemy, and the collateral damage is their own organs.
The reason this connects back to the impossibility of zero side effects is that immune system variability is essentially infinite. Every person's HLA type is different. Certain HLA types are associated with specific drug reactions. Abacavir, an HIV drug, causes a severe hypersensitivity reaction in about 5 to 8% of patients, but almost exclusively in people with the HLA B5701 allele. Screen for that allele, don't give the drug to people who have it, and the reaction essentially disappears.
That one we can predict.
That one we can predict because the association is so strong. But for most idiosyncratic reactions, we don't have that kind of clean genetic marker. We find out when someone gets sick.
Which brings us to the conceptual tool that regulators and clinicians use to think about all of this. Number needed to treat and number needed to harm.
NNT and NH. Number needed to treat is how many people you need to give the drug to for one person to get the desired benefit. Number needed to harm is how many people you need to treat before one person experiences a specific adverse event. The ideal drug has a low NNT and a high NNH. But here's where it gets interesting. For isotretinoin, the NNT might be around 2 or 3. It works for almost everyone. The NNH for severe fetal malformations if taken during pregnancy is about 3 to 5. That's terrifyingly close. The benefit and the harm are separated not by the drug's inherent safety profile, but by the systems we build around it. The pregnancy testing, the contraception, the monthly monitoring.
The NNH isn't a fixed property of the drug. It's a property of the drug plus the system in which it's prescribed.
And that's the whole logic of REMS. You can't change the drug's teratogenicity, but you can change the NNH by preventing the exposure that leads to the harm. For clozapine, the NNH for agranulocytosis without monitoring is about 100. With mandatory blood monitoring, you catch the white cell drop before it becomes catastrophic.
Then there's the case where the NNH looks acceptable until you multiply it by the population.
The absolute risk increase for cardiovascular events over placebo was about 1.5%. That gives you an NNH of roughly 67. That might sound acceptable for a pain drug, except that 80 million people took it. When you do that multiplication, you're looking at over 1 million excess events. The Vigor trial showed a fourfold increase in myocardial infarction risk compared to naproxen. But the debate was whether rofecoxib was causing heart attacks or naproxen was preventing them. Genuine scientific uncertainty, and while the debate played out over years, millions of people kept taking the drug. That's not a regulatory failure in the simple sense. It's a reflection of how hard it is to resolve a safety signal when the absolute risk is small and the mechanism isn't fully understood.
That's what I keep coming back to. The FDA isn't working with certainty. It's working with probabilities, and those probabilities shift over time as more data comes in. The approval decision is a snapshot of what we know at a moment. It's not a guarantee.
Which is exactly why the post-market piece matters so much. FA ears is where the real safety signal detection happens for rare events, but spontaneous reporting captures somewhere between 1 and 10% of actual adverse events. For every report in FAERS, there are somewhere between 10 and 100 unreported cases walking around, and you don't have a reliable denominator, so you can't calculate a true incidence rate. The FDA uses something called the proportional reporting ratio and Bayesian data mining to spot patterns. If drug X has 50 reports of liver failure and most drugs in its class have 2, that's a signal worth investigating, but it's not proof. It's a hypothesis generator.
The system is designed to flag things that might be problems, not to confirm that they are.
And that's the right design, given the constraints. You want a sensitive system that casts a wide net, even if it generates false positives, because the cost of missing a real safety signal is so high. The confirmation comes later, through targeted studies, through the Sentinel Initiative.
How does the FDA actually operationalize this? What does the benefit-risk framework look like in practice?
It's structured, but not formulaic. The agency looks at 4 dimensions: severity of the condition being treated, size of the treatment effect, nature and frequency of the adverse events, and availability of alternative therapies. Those 4 things interact. A drug for a terminal cancer with no other options gets enormous latitude. A drug for seasonal allergies with 10 competitors on the market gets almost none.
The same side effect profile could get a drug approved for glioblastoma and rejected for hay fever.
Not just could. The FDA has approved cancer drugs with 5% fatal adverse event rates. For a metastatic cancer where the alternative is dying from the disease in months, that's an acceptable trade-off. For allergic rhinitis, a 0.1% serious adverse event rate can trigger a black box warning or an outright rejection, and that's rational. The baseline risk you're already carrying from the untreated disease sets the ceiling for what's acceptable from the treatment.
That's the framework Daniel was asking about. There is no universal threshold.
The FDA's guidance says that for common adverse events, those occurring in 5% or more of patients, the agency expects them to be characterized and tolerable. For serious adverse events, the expectation is typically rates below 1 to 2% above placebo, but those are starting points for negotiation, not bright line rules, and that's where REMS enters the picture. The FDA's primary tool for saying, we're not comfortable with the risk as it stands, but we think it can be managed. Isotretinoin is the archetypal example. The drug's inherent risk profile is unacceptable, but the drug plus system risk profile is acceptable.
Then there's the more recent example, zuranolone for postpartum depression, approved in 2023.
The clinical trials showed higher rates of sedation and dizziness compared to placebo, not trivial side effects for a new mother caring for an infant. But the FDA approved it because untreated postpartum depression carries its own severe risks. Suicide is a leading cause of maternal death in the postpartum period. The risk of the disease was judged to outweigh the risk of the side effects.
That's the calculus in its purest form. It's not that the side effects don't matter, it's that the alternative is worse.
Which brings us back to the central point. When we talk about drug safety, we're not talking about a property of the molecule. We're talking about a property of the molecule, plus the disease it treats, plus the population it treats, plus the systems we build around it. Change any one of those, and the safety calculus changes.
Is this drug safe? Is almost a meaningless question. The meaningful question is this drug safe enough for this use in this population, given what we know and what we're watching for?
That's the question the FDA actually answers. It's just not the question most people think they're asking. If you're a patient listening to this, what do you actually do with it? Because the takeaway isn't, don't trust medications. The takeaway is, understand what you're being told when someone says a drug is safe.
The first thing to understand is that no side effects is a marketing fantasy. The real question is whether the benefits outweigh the risks for your specific physiology, and the answer to that question has error bars.
Which brings me to something practical. You can now get a report that tells you your CYP2C19 and CYP2D6 metabolizer status. For certain drugs, this information is genuinely actionable, but with a huge caveat. Pharmacogenomics can tell you if you're a poor metabolizer or an ultra-rapid metabolizer for specific enzymes. What it cannot do is predict idiosyncratic reactions. It won't tell you if your immune system is going to decide that a drug metabolite looks like an invader and mount an autoimmune attack on your liver.
It's useful but incomplete, like checking the weather forecast before a hike. It tells you if it's going to rain, not if you're going to twist your ankle.
That's fair. And the marketing around some of these direct-to-consumer genetic tests can oversell what they actually deliver.
There's something even more immediate that anyone can do, and it doesn't require a genetic test. When a doctor prescribes a new medication, most people ask about the common side effects. Almost nobody asks the two questions that actually get at the rare but serious risk.
What was the rate of serious adverse events in the clinical trials, and what post-market surveillance is in place for this drug? Has the FDA required a REMS program? Is there active monitoring, or is it just passive reporting in the theories? Those questions change the conversation from, is this safe, to, what do we know and what are we watching for?
I suspect most doctors would be caught off guard by those questions.
They would, and that's fine. The point isn't to grow your physician. The point is to shift your own mental model. You're not asking for a guarantee. You're asking for the parameters of the uncertainty.
That's a much more adult relationship with your own healthcare. Accepting that every medication is a bet, and the question is whether it's a good bet for you, not whether it's a sure thing. Here's the question I keep turning over. We've got AI-designed drugs entering trials. We've got mRNA vaccines being tailored to individual tumor mutations. The promise is that we're moving toward therapies so precisely targeted that the side effect profile fundamentally shrinks. But after everything we'd just laid out, does it actually?
I think it shrinks the predictable stuff. If you design a molecule computationally to hit one specific receptor subtype and nothing else, you probably get fewer off-target effects. That's real. But the biological variability problem doesn't go away. Your immune system doesn't care how elegantly the molecule was designed. It just sees a foreign protein and decides whether to attack.
The AI can reduce the number of things that go wrong for predictable reasons. But it can't touch the idiosyncratic reactions, the 1 in 50,000 immune freakouts, the metabolic outliers.
And there's a deeper issue. The more targeted the therapy, the more you need to know about the individual patient. An mRNA vaccine tailored to your specific tumor mutations is, by definition, an N of one therapy. You can't run a 3,000-person trial on it. The entire regulatory framework built around population-level statistics starts to break down.
Which means we might be heading toward a world where acceptable risk isn't defined by what happened to 3,000 people in a trial. It's defined by what we can predict about you, specifically.
That's the frontier. Real-world evidence, N-of-1 trials, Bayesian adaptive designs that update as data accumulates. The FDA has already started building frameworks for this. Their real-world evidence program, the Sentinel Initiative's expansion into active surveillance. The goal is to move from, this drug is safe for the average patient, to this drug is safe for you, given your genetics, your biomarkers, your history.
That's still a bet. It's just a bet with better inputs.
It's always a bet. The question is how good the odds are and how well you understand them. And I think that's actually the most honest place we've landed in this whole conversation. The goal was never zero risk. The goal is better information, faster detection, and a regulatory system that's humble enough to keep watching.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The name Al-Idrisi, the great 12th century Islamic cartographer, derives from the Arabic word for student or disciple, reflecting the tradition that mapmakers were scholars first and geographers second. His Tabula Rogeriana, completed in 1154, remained the most accurate world map in existence for three centuries.
Uh-huh. Mapmakers as students. That actually tracks.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in, we'll chase the thread.
My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear hose.
My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.